Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcasts too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. It's been just over a year since California essentially reopened. The state made masking optional. Schools and businesses dropped restrictions. In that time, we've endured surges and virus mutations that made COVID more contagious than ever. But thankfully, deaths remained relatively low. Now, it seems almost everyone who avoided infection in the pandemic's first 2 years has been getting it. As we prepare to gather for the July 4th holiday, UCSF's Dr. Peter Chin Hong joins us to answer your questions about testing, treatments, and vaccine effectiveness. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. An advisory committee to the FDA has recommended that COVID vaccines be redesigned to better protect against the highly contagious Omicron subvariants. Coronavirus cases have now reached the 10 million mark in California since the pandemic began, though that number is widely considered an undercount. And case rates here remain high. Joining me now is Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco Medical Center. Always appreciate having you on, Dr. Chin Hong.
Always a pleasure, Mina. Thanks for having me on. And it's great to be in studio.
Yeah, thank you for coming into studio. First, what can you tell us about this advisory committee to the FDA? The main reasons behind this advisory panel's vote yesterday to recommend these reformulated boosters to better fight against Omicron's offshoots?
Well, Mina, the main rationale is that even though the vaccines are really spectacular, particularly if you remind the immune system at preventing serious disease, hospitalization, and death, they've been coming up short lately at preventing infection. And as everyone who's listening knows, just getting a breakthrough infection, even if it's mild, means that it's terribly disruptive to your life, to society. You're taken out of school or work. Somebody might have to take time off to take care of you. And if we can prevent that by updating the virus to make the spikes on the spike protein, or the spike proteins look a little bit more like what's going around now, that might not just prevent serious disease, but also prevent infection.
So if people are weighing when to get their next booster, should they wait for this reformulated vaccine? How soon could it be available since this was a recommendation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my advice is really to go out and get your booster if you're eligible and not to wait. And the reason is as follows. First of all, there's still debate as to what the nature of the cocktail would be like for the updated variant booster. Is it going to be the original plus Omicron BA1 that we saw in January? Is it going to be the original plus the new kids on the block, BA4 and BA5? The Moderna and Pfizer companies were banking on the fact that it would have been the original Omicron variant plus the Wuhan variant, because they already started making them. If that were the case, that would be available very soon, maybe at the end of summer. But many people in the FDA advisory board think, why go to the past? I mean, BA1 is such old news now. We should be looking to the future. And right now, the future is all about BA4 and BA5. If we waited to include those two, just the fact of producing them means that we're looking at the end of October, early November.
I see. And it's really the winter surge that they're worried about. So it would be almost like right under the wire.
Yeah. And so time and time again, we've already been behind the eight ball with this COVID virus. And we're for one saying, well, let's just be a little bit avant-garde and think about the now and future rather than, you know, 5 million years ago in COVID years.
That said, though, I almost wonder, as we can see, the mutations are happening all the time. Could the vaccine that gets developed that includes BA4 and BA5 be almost outdated by the winter surge?
That is definitely a possibility. But maybe the next sublineage, it seems to be all flavors of Omicron now, but maybe we might get a Pi or a Rho or a Sigma. It's always going to be a calculated guess. But again, I want to scope back to the 30,000-foot view, which is regardless of what we do, we're still doing pretty well at keeping the most vulnerable people away from the ICU, away from dying if they get up to date on their vaccines.
And so also, big news has been that COVID vaccines are finally available for kids under 5 in the U.S. What would you like parents to know about the differences between the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine for kids under 5?
Yeah, so those are all great questions. The biggest difference between Moderna and Pfizer for parents to know is that Moderna is a higher dose, so you just need two doses spread apart by 4 weeks, so you can get done faster. Pfizer is a smaller dose, Moderna, quarter of the adult dose, Pfizer, 1/10 of the adult dose. So you need three shots spread across 11 weeks to complete the series. So if you want to do it fast, go for Moderna. You might get a little bit more side effects, nothing like even older kids or adolescents, because it's still a smaller dose, but more than the Pfizer dose. And the Pfizer, if you're not in a rush, the three doses spread across 11 weeks is another option. But, you know, just like we say for adults, it depends on what's being stocked at the particular location you're going to. And I would just, you know, if I had an under 5-year-old, I'd probably get what was soonest available. Although if I were planning a trip to visit grandma or grandpa at the end of summer and I wanted to be done or have more confidence earlier, I'd probably get Moderna.
I see. So there have been some differences reported in terms of vaccine efficacy. For example, there have been reports that Pfizer's vaccine reduced the risk of symptomatic infection by 80% in kids between 6 months and 4. Moderna's was like 37% in kids 2 to 5. But at the same time, we're being told that these aren't necessarily apples to apples comparisons. For parents who are wanting to get the most effective ones, what would you recommend if it's not available? Would you just say again, just go ahead and get what's available, that it's really, they're both effective and it's really, these numbers can be hard to compare.
Yeah, the numbers are super hard to interpret. And the reason is a couple of reasons. First of all, they were done at different times. So, you know, Pfizer actually went back to the drawing board because they were banking on a two-dose series and then the two doses didn't look good enough. Then they added the third. And then Moderna started a little bit later, but then got done earlier. So you would say that Pfizer probably represents you know, some of the later subvariants, Moderna a little bit earlier. So it's hard to compare the two. Plus the Pfizer 80% is based on a smaller number of people, which is really statistically unsound. So at the end of the day, you can't really compare the 80 to the 50%. And also, no vaccine really works well against symptomatic infection, even in adults. Now, most prominently, I think we are expecting that it will do exceptionally well at preventing the most serious outcomes in these kids.
And even with the recommendation for reformulated vaccines, these are still really good ones to give to children.
Exactly, because we can't predict which kids are going to be hospitalized. I was really astonished to find out that during Omicron, more kids under 5 were hospitalized than those over 5. And that's because they were not eligible for vaccines. And of the kids who were hospitalized under 5, 50% of them had absolutely no risk factors that we would think about, like congenital heart disease or neurological disease, to really predict why they were being hospitalized. Suffice to say, we can't look at a kid and use some magic you know, lenses to say this kid is going to be hospitalized, so I might as well really make sure they get vaccinated, or this kid is definitely going to be safe.
Certainly a thought for parents who may be on the fence about vaccinating their kids under five. We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF Medical Center, and your listeners are invited to join the conversation with your COVID questions or your thoughts on the latest pandemic developments. You can email them to forum@kqed.org. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. You can call with them at 866-733-6786. Again, your questions to 866-733-6786. Dr. Chin Hong, while we're on the subject of vaccines, there was another announcement yesterday from federal officials, and this was actually related to monkeypox, that clinics nationwide will begin offering vaccinations against monkeypox, essentially to anyone who may have been exposed to the virus. We're at over 300 cases, as I understand it, in 27 states now, maybe some 50 or so in California. The case numbers are going up. How worried should we be about our ability to contain monkeypox?
I think we're probably not going to contain monkeypox anymore, but it's still not going to be a threat to the general population. I'll explain that apparent contradiction in a few minutes. So the reason why I don't think we can contain it doesn't mean that I'm pessimistic and that we'll all be afflicted with monkeypox. It means that it may probably become endemic. And it means that it would be one of the things we think about when somebody comes into clinic with a rash or an ulcer, particularly in the genital area, and it probably won't go away. And the reason why I don't think we can make it go away anymore is because we're detecting it now in the wastewater in Northern California. We are not using enough diagnostic tests, so we can't keep the people who have infection away from the people who don't have infection. So I think that, you know, if we deploy vaccines very, very efficiently, which I think the feds are hoping to do, we might be able to nip it in the bud. But again, it's all over the world right now. It's very hidden because you can't really tell immediately. There's a very, very long incubation period. And it prevents very, very subtly. It's not like when you Google monkeypox and you see these dramatic images of that boy that they always show in the pictures with the boils on the arm. Yes. It looks very, very subtle, and it could be missed. People might think it's a staph infection or a boil or even like herpes. I think with a combination of strategies, we might be able to do something about it. But again, with a lot of Pride weekends already passed, we might have missed our golden opportunity.
You did say, though, that we should focus on silver linings related to this infection. What is that?
So there actually are a lot of silver linings. And first of all, it's not probably going to be at risk to the general population. It hasn't killed anyone. It's not a deadly disease. In our country, we had a lot of experience before in the early 2000s, 2003, with a monkeypox outbreak in pet owners of prairie dogs that were housed next to these rats that had monkeypox, and the pet owners got it, and nobody died. Nobody has died, as far as I know, and more than 4,000 people around the world who have gotten it so far. Other silver linings, we have a vaccine. It's very good. Jynneos is the one that the feds are distributing now. We have therapeutics. There's even immune globulin. We haven't had to use therapeutics. So lots of silver linings.
Well, thanks for touching on that with us. We're talking about COVID this hour, and we're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong. And you can share your questions or your experiences with COVID these days by posting them on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, emailing forum@kqed.org, or calling us 866-733-6786. We'll have more after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Here's what we're talking about tomorrow. The Supreme Court, in addition to taking away Americans' constitutional right to an abortion, has struck down gun regulations, broadly expanded religious rights. We'll break down the most significant rulings, and we want to hear from you. What do the opinions from this ground-shifting term represent to you? You can leave a voicemail by calling 415-553-3300. This hour, we're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco Medical Center, and taking your COVID questions at 866-733-6786 from Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum, and from your emails to forum@kqed.org. And let me go to Amelia in Santa Rosa. Hi, Amelia.
Hi, good morning. I have a 4-year-old daughter, and she currently has COVID. I know. We've made it like this whole time without it. Sorry.
Yeah. No, you are not alone. It feels like so many people have avoided it in the previous couple years and have it now.
I'm a teacher, and so I've been on that side of this whole pandemic. I was pregnant all last year. I was thankful to be boosted in my third trimester, so I'm hoping that my now 4-month-old son at least has a teeny bit of protection. So she's 4. We had an appointment for her vaccine this Saturday, but then she got COVID, so we couldn't go to that appointment. But my question is, now that she has had COVID or is having COVID, when is she able to get a vaccine? How long does she have to wait before she actually can get a vaccine?
Amelia, thanks. Dr. Chin Hong?
Hi, Amelia, and so sorry about your daughter, and kudos to you for being a teacher during all of these trying times. I really have so much admiration for you. First of all, in terms of when it's safe to get a vaccine after having had COVID, now experts believe that you can get the vaccine as soon as you feel better. So there's nothing keeping you away from making that appointment as long as your daughter is feeling better. You're not going to feel, she's not going to get much worse if she's getting the vaccine after then. But immunologically speaking, in the old days, you would say 3 months would probably be a good window period for the maximum time you can wait. But now with the new variants afoot, I think people are saying 4 weeks to 6 weeks would be sort of like the max that I would wait before, not getting the vaccine or starting the vaccine series.
Well, Amelia, thanks. And I hope your 4-year-old feels better soon. Let me go to Charlie next. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning. Thank you for this update on COVID. I really appreciate it. I'm 71 and I have a high risk, specifically mitochondrial disease with dysautonomia, because the doctor would need to know that. I'm wondering if there's anything I could do. I've been not going out so much. I've been avoiding crowds. And I have been double masking with an N95 and a blue mask on top of that to protect others. But I am worried that my vaccines may be wearing, and I'm very high risk, as the doctor would understand from my diagnosis.
Well, Charlie, thanks. Anything more that Charlie can do? It sounds like he's already doing a lot.
Yeah, Charlie, you're doing a lot already. I would say, like, some of the other things you can talk to a healthcare professional about, although I'm sure you have already, is just, getting a good sense of how you responded to the vaccine. I assume you have. And if so, you add one, as an immunocompromised person, potentially to what the general population guidelines are. For example, if those over 50 are eligible for two additional shots, you could be eligible for three additional. So I would say, you know, after, you know, are you up to date on that? In that respect, I assume you are. And then number two, if you're not, haven't, or haven't really taken to the vaccines, I think what a lot of people haven't explored as fully still is the idea of using long-acting monoclonal antibodies like Evusheld. I had a patient recently, for example, who was also very, very worried about moving, going out into the world, particularly around with high circulating virus, ended immune compromise as well, ended up getting Evusheld and feels a lot better about that, because you know at least that that those pre-made antibodies would be circulating around. And again, nothing is going to be zero risk or one risk. So the other aspect, of course, is to make sure that you know how you're going to be, where you're going to get your Paxlovid from in the eventuality that you would get infected, who's going to prescribe it to you, what are your drug-drug interactions, and which drugstore close to you will have it?
Well, Charlie, thank you for the question. And it's also making me think about, for people who don't want to contribute to other people's risk, what should they do with what feels like right now the omnipresence of these Omicron subvariants?
No, it's very, very hard, Mina. And I think, you know, we do the best that we can. It sounds really simplistic to say, but again, we have multiple tools, and the more tools you deploy, the lower the risk. But you're not going to eliminate the risk to zero. Take case in point is, for example, the first caller, Emilia. Her daughter is ill, and even though Emilia has taken all the precautions in the world, what I've seen, and many of my colleagues even at work in the hospital, is that they became infected because they had to take care of their kids, because you can't ask the four-year-old to isolate and just put some food under the door. You have to actively take care of that kid, and that's how a lot of people are becoming infected, even though they've taken so many precautions during the year. So I think that, you know, again, you try to do the best you can, and again, we have more tools than a year ago when we tried to reopen, and that's really the idea that if somebody was ill, there are a lot of other things that we can do to keep them away from the hospital now, not just Paxlovid or monoclonal antibodies, but even alternatives like 3 days of remdesivir, or when you get into the hospital, we're much better at keeping you away from the ICU. So there are a lot of things that we've been better at in the last 2.5 years.
Well, let me go next to caller Steve in San Jose. Hi, Steve.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question is more about the vaccines. You know, we heard a lot about the potential twindemic the last couple of winters with flu and with COVID, and it didn't really pan out, perhaps because, you know, there was masks and, you know, we weren't fully reopened. Curious what your perspectives on that for this upcoming winter, and do you foresee us rapidly moving to an mRNA-style flu vaccine at some point here, just given the rapidly changing virus.
Steve, thanks.
Both on the flu and COVID side.
Yeah.
That's a great question from Steve. I don't see any changes in the flu vaccine yet for this moment, but I do see a change in the potential administration of the flu vaccine. And for Moderna, for example, is combining a flu vaccine with a COVID booster in one shot. So like you don't have to get two shots. So I think that will be great. So you see more combination vaccines. And the flu season is going to come back. We're already seeing upticks in the southern hemisphere this year, higher than the last 2 years. I know we've cried wolf for the last 2 years, but then people stayed still because of the variants that were circulating at the time, Delta and then Omicron the following year. It kept our flu numbers down. But right now, I think with everyone moving and what we're seeing in Australia, Brazil, et cetera, we're expecting a regular flu season, which in its normal terms will kill 30,000 people. In a bad flu season, you're talking about 60 to 80,000 deaths, which are still lower than the number of COVID deaths we have daily right now, about 300.
Well, Anna writes, if one had COVID at the end of May in the Bay Area, what's your best guess about which variant it was? Wondering if I had Omicron 4 or 5, meaning BA4 or BA5, and am thus a little more protected going into the summer.
No, I think that's a great question. I think at the end of May, BA4 and BA5 are really increasing very, very rapidly. It's the most rapidly increasing variant, which means that at the end of May, we had some data that the circulating variant, more than 60% chance, was a variant of BA2, which is had the very memorable name of BA2.12.1, which first started off in the central New York and then spread to the rest of the country. So unfortunately, probably was not BA4 or BA5.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UC San Francisco Medical Center, and taking your questions about COVID as California's high case rates remain ahead of the July 4th holiday. And I'm sure people want to protect themselves and others as well. There's a question on testing here. The sister writes, can someone who tests negative with a home test still be contagious? I think this is a really interesting question because for a lot of people, we've been hearing that antigen tests are not quite as effective against these Omicron subvariants, meaning they're not quite as good at detecting them. And we've seen reports of vaccinated people who test negative even when they have symptoms and then test positive. So how should we review the results of one negative antigen test if we're trying to, you know, protect people, make decisions about whether we should be indoors with others and so on?
I love that question. First of all, in general, the rapid test is a good measure of transmissibility, but again, it's not, 100% great at it. And let's just get back to the basic principles. A rapid antigen test, you need more than 100,000 virus to be positive. A PCR test, you just need a few, even less than 10. So the point is that the reason why vaccinated people feel sicker earlier, many people believe, is that you already have these circulating immune cells ready to pounce, and they react even when a few viruses is there before the antigen test turns positive. But if you're just like going for a quick event, you rapidly screen negative, and then you go into the event and you leave, chances are you're not going to transmit. But if you're staying in the event or it's a family reunion that lasts for a day or a weekend, you can imagine a situation where you're converting after that initial negative test while as the virus reproduces enough to reach that over 100,000 mark.
Mm. So then you should, if you're going to spend multiple days, maybe test more
daily.
Than once.
Yeah.
Yes, test daily. I see. Okay. We're also getting a lot of questions about timing of shots. So I want to ask you a couple of those. For example, this listener wants to know, can you talk a little bit about the timing of a booster for kids over 5? My vaccinated 6-year-old child is outside at local camps all summer, and I'm contemplating waiting until closer to the start of school for her booster. What does the evidence say about booster timing?
Yeah, so what was studied in the data for kids is really at a 5-month mark. So you can get a booster at 5 months or so, but there's no science around why 5 months is chosen. The idea is that you remind the immune system, a few months after the original series. And that's how vaccines work best. They work that way in hepatitis B and human papillomavirus. And many kids have received measles, mumps, and rubella. It's the same principle. So that's the idea, and how you interpret it could be based on what your timing is. And if you think, rightly so, that the highest risk and you want to optimize antibodies are around school time, and there's not going to be a lot of vacationing with lots of crowds during the summer, you can wait 2 weeks before school because it's still in that window period for really reminding the immune system for the future. Again, you're boosting for the future, not necessarily as much for the present, which is because these vaccines are not going to be as great long-term for, breakthrough infection, but great at the most serious outcomes.
Let me go to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. I have a daughter who's home with a 5-day-old baby. She's nursing the baby. She has COVID. She also had it while she was pregnant. So we're hoping the baby has some immunity from that event. She is very worried because she has a dry cough, and she's not sure if it's a symptom of COVID or maybe from wearing her mask for so many days for so long. It's irritating her throat. But so she's still wearing the mask, double masking around the baby and all day, and very worried about transmitting COVID to the baby. What other precautions besides a mask might there be?
Thanks, Mary.
That's a great question, Mary. You know, I wonder if your daughter can just get a PCR test, because if that PCR is negative, I would feel very confident that that dry cough, at least at this point, is not going to be COVID. But of course, repeating the rapid antigen test at least 3 times over 3 days might also give you the same information, but it'll be, you know, it'll take a longer time. So that probably would be my best advice, because the other things, you know, I'm not sure you'd need them if it's not COVID. But that said, there are also other infections that a mom who's coughing can spread to the baby. But again, many of those, if in a young baby under 6 months old, would have had, you know, would be the antibodies from the mom would have gone to the baby to help protect the baby in that early time period. So those are, you know, some of the considerations. You know, all the usual other things, washing hands will be important for lots of other viruses, et cetera, apart from the mask. But I think ruling out COVID by using a sensitive test might be the best first step.
When was the last time she tested, Mary? Do you know?
She did get a positive PCR test 3 days ago.
3 days
ago. Oh, okay. I misunderstood that. So if she had a positive PCR 3 days ago, I think, you know, just doing the best that you can. The baby probably already has positive antibodies from the time during the time of pregnancy, and waiting and checking rapid tests until they turn negative. If they're negative, I would feel confident that there's going to be no more transmission.
Great to hear that she likely passed on the antibodies, but 5-day-old newborn, I can only imagine, Mary. Thanks for the call. Let me go to Stephen in Berkeley. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, thanks for a great COVID update program. My wife and I are both in our late 60s, both vaccinated and boosted, and we contracted COVID about a month ago, and both had, at the same time, pretty serious flu symptoms. On day 3, she opted for Paxlovid, and I opted for Betalovimab infusion, and it turned out that she remained positive until day 15, and I was positive only till day 7. And I'm wondering if the doctor has seen this in the field, that kind of difference.
Thanks, Stephen. I don't know that I've heard of Benlavabid, or if I'm saying that right.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So I think that's a great question from Stephen. So what Stephen is illustrating is that there are different ways to treat people who've become acutely ill to keep them away from the hospital. One is the drug we've heard about, Paxlovid, which shuts down the virus factory it's an antiviral drug. And then the other is monoclonal antibodies, which the Bebtelovimab is a Lilly product, kind of like Regeneron, but updated to be better against Omicron flavors. So it's pre-made antibodies that just neutralize the virus, so it acts really faster. But it's harder to give because you need to get an IV. You need to get an IV. You need an hour of observation, and you need a place to go to. So what he's illustrating, two different ways of treating it. The Paxlovid, of course, is associated with people with rebound, but not most people. I would say probably 20% of people, although it seems that when you talk to everybody, everybody seems to have had it. But I've seen a lot of successes from it as well, just very portable. And the monoclonal antibodies also have a lot of use, but it's harder to give, and that's the main difference.
Well, thanks for that question and for letting us know about it, Stephen. And we're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF Medical Center, an infectious disease specialist there, doing a COVID update, taking your questions, hearing your experiences. Email forum at kqed.org. Post thoughts and questions on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. Call us 866-733-6786. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Does it feel like everyone you know these days has or has had COVID? UCSF's Dr. Peter Chin Hong is here to answer your questions about the virus, variants, prevention, treatment, and more. And you can join the conversation by emailing forum@kqed.org, posting them on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or by calling us 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Let me go to Stuart in San Francisco. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Dr. Chin Hong, thanks for being such a sane and also good-natured voice during this pandemic. Could you respond to what your UCSF colleague, Dr. Monica Gandhi, wrote just a few days ago in the San Francisco Chronicle when she said, "We should reassure the public that long COVID can be prevented through vaccination." Her comments seem to contradict what you and others like Dr. Bob Wachter have said about the risks of long COVID. And just recently, we've been hearing that reinfection with COVID can lead to even higher risk of long COVID. So could you just help us make sense of these kind of contradictory opinions?
Stuart, thanks. Dr. Chin Hong?
Thanks, Stuart, for your kind words. And it's really been an honor and privilege, really, to be able to speak to the community during COVID. So I appreciate your comments. Regarding risk, I think it's really, really hard. My view on all of it, and let's just pick on long COVID for now, is that, again, just like the idea of catching COVID, it's not really bipolar, you know, it's not like 0-1, but in terms of reducing risk. And I can't say that you won't get COVID, long COVID, by being vaccinated, in the same way that I can't say that you won't get reinfection, even if you've gotten recent COVID. There's just a lower risk of it rather than saying there's absolutely no risk. So I think the way to think about it is just like the way you think about putting on layers of protection, the more layers you put on, the lower the risk. So in terms of long COVID, the ways that you can limit your probability of getting it includes, you know, if you have a milder case, you're less likely to get it. If you're up to date on vaccines and boosted, you're less likely to get it. If you are, if you're getting Omicron flavor versus the earlier variants, you're less likely to get it. But that doesn't mean that there are people who are vaccinated and who got Omicron who don't get it. It's just that it's a lower likely risk. And that's really, really uncomfortable because we have to take all these calculations and put it in our own perspective and think about what that means to us and our own situation. So for some people, it may mean not doing indoor dining until the virus gets to a certain level in the community, say much lower than what it is now. For other people, they might be willing to take that risk or just roll the dice a little bit, you know, with that odds of, you know, the highest probably 1 in 20. But again, not all of it will be really, really severe that will last more than a year. So I think everyone is saying a little bit of the truth. But I think the real answer is the volume, the gradation of scale between, you're definitely going to get it or you're not going to get it.
There was new federal data. Thank you, Stuart, by the way, for that question. There was new federal data from the National Center for Health Statistics that said that roughly 20 million people are currently living with long COVID symptoms. It just came out. And I am wondering, Dr. Chin Hong, if we have learned anything more about why some people get long COVID, how common it really is, since I know those results are self-reported.
Yeah, so those are all great questions. First of all, I think we don't know a lot about long COVID. I have a lot of respect for people who have long COVID. I think one symptom that everybody's had who has long COVID, who I've spoken to, is not like necessary brain fog or palpitations or shortness of breath. It's stigma. And it's stigma on when they come to see their healthcare professional. It's stigma when they tell their neighbor they have chronic symptoms. And I think that can't be underestimated. So I have a lot of respect for those who have it. With that said, it's probably a variety of diseases. It's probably in two main categories. One is that it's an overactive immune system that needs to be tempered down, or there's archived virus that may benefit from antivirals. There have been some early reports that some people with long COVID you respond to Paxlovid, but it's probably not everyone, and we need to understand more. And that's why the government is actually spending more than $1 billion, and others as well, in efforts to do so, but the answers won't come immediately. And that's recovercovid.org. If you Google that and you have these chronic symptoms, it's probably a good place to be evaluated as well, to have community and to be part of the effort to understand this really, really challenging conundrum that we're in. And the scope is just breathtaking, like you said, Mina. Even if we think that the 20% of people who might have chronic symptoms, of those, maybe even 5% might have really debilitating that lasts for over a year, that includes cognitive or brain fog. That's millions of people that probably would have their workforce and their lives disrupted for some time. So we really need to address it.
Yeah, you mentioned stigma. There's even on maybe a slightly lower level, but I've heard people talk about feeling some sense of guilt or embarrassment that they've gotten COVID. What would you say to people who are feeling these kinds of feelings and beating themselves up in this way?
Definitely not. I mean, I see it in my colleagues all the time. I mean, we're in healthcare, right? And we're, been the masked people that you see in billboards and stuff like that, telling you to be vaccinated. And then you get long COVID and you're like, while you're kind of like shifting your eyes away or wearing sunglasses and stuff like that. But the point is, it's not a moral failure. We all have things to do. And I think really the case in point is really, taking care of parents or grandparents or kids who have had COVID, and there's nobody else to do that. And you're the one. There's only so much you can do in the face of a transmissible variant. So I would say, definitely know that it's not your failure. So many people have been so careful have gotten it. But at the same time, if you're lucky enough not to have gotten it so far, still take as many risks as possible. And if you've gotten it before, try to not get it again by just using all the protections that you know how to use the best that you can, while engaging in life as zestfully as you want to, because we all should be doing that.
Dr. Peter Chin Hong is infectious disease specialist at UCSF Medical Center. And this listener writes, does the CDC 5-day quarantine guideline after a positive test still hold? Dr. Chin Hong?
Hello, yes. After a positive test, isolation for 5 days minimum still holds. It's not so in other countries, but it still holds in the United States. And the way you think about it is, after day 5, you can exit isolation if you have a negative test up to day 10. But after day 10, many experts recommend not testing anymore. So that's the way to think about it. 5 days is the minimum. You can get out before day 10, but you need a negative test. After day 10, don't worry testing, because we don't know what that positive test may mean, unless you're in a situation like healthcare, like I am, where I really have to make sure I'm negative before I go back to work.
Laura writes, and again, listeners, you can post online at Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum, or by emailing forum@kqed.org. Some of you already posted before the show. Laura writes, at this point, is someone who has never vaxxed still potentially more likely to get a more severe infection and therefore be more infectious to others, even to those of us who have kept up with the boosters, there are these questions with regards to the risk posed by unvaccinated people, both to themselves and others.
Yeah, so for unvaccinated people, there are more tools out there now. Maybe you didn't get the vaccine because you were afraid of or had a bad side effect or you aren't able to get it. You can get long-acting monoclonal antibodies, which are different. There are new types of vaccines that are not mRNA. One that has been recently FDA, you know, given the green light by the FDA advisory board, but not the CDC, and that's Novavax. Very old-fashioned technique, very, very good vaccine. And then number three, if you do get infected, you can reduce the risk of transmission to others by just taking Paxlovid because your viral load will drop very, very rapidly in the first day or two. So again, different strokes for different folks now, and we are not necessarily one size fits all anymore, and we can all still do lots of things to protect each other.
Is it this idea, though, of a milder virus, since it has fewer hospitalizations and relatively fewer deaths associated with it, does it mean it's also milder for the unvaccinated?
Not necessarily. It depends on a whole host of other things, and I'll give you a case in point. In Hong Kong, for example, as everyone knows, they were not very vaccinated, surprisingly, and they had Omicron BA2, and it decimated that territory, and they ran out of beds and morgues and all of that stuff, body bags all over the place. So again, Omicron can do bad things too if it hits the right soil. But it's probably the older you are, the more severe it's going to occur in you.
Well, this listener, Bettina, tweets, "It will be 6 months since my fourth shot when I plan to travel to Europe. I'm 61 years old and have not had COVID-19. Can I get another booster before going?" So 6 months since fourth shot.
So if Bettina is 61 and she's had four shots, she would not normally be eligible for getting an additional booster, but she can definitely talk to her healthcare professional in case there are other nuances that may make her eligible to get a fourth shot. But in a biological and scientific sense, if it's 6 months since your last shot, you can certainly use a booster to top off your antibodies. You wouldn't get more antibodies, but you can kind of restore it to kind of give you the best defenses if you're going to be traveling.
Mark in Oakland, thanks for waiting. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, last month I was one of those people who had symptoms, and it took me 3 at-home tests over 2 days before I showed positive. I'm wondering, since then I've read that if you swab the back of your throat in addition to your nasal passages for the at-home test, you are more likely to detect the virus earlier. Is that true?
Thanks, Mark.
I love Mark's question. So in Omicron, what we know is that unlike the previous variants, the virus really loves these large airways, the back of your throat, and it kind of like it's really set up shop there, and it's replicating like crazy there. And then only after a while it goes up to your nose. So if you're swabbing your nose, you can be swabbing your nose till tomorrow. If the action is in your throat, you wouldn't be capturing it until enough time has elapsed. So some people have combined the throat and the nose in the same swab. And apart from the ick factor, and I probably have no ick factor anymore after being in medicine for so long, you can certainly increase the yield. It's not official. Nobody in the U.S. is going to tell you to officially do it. But I find it very interesting that in the U.K., they actually recommend this, and they have videos about it from the government. So if you Google U.K. Throat and nose swab on YouTube, you can find instructions on how to do it. But it's not really rocket science. You basically just combine the two. I think it's a good alternative for people who are worried that they actually might have COVID, don't want to go out and get a PCR test, and don't want to wait 3 days with a bunch of other tests before finding out for sure.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF Medical Center, an infectious disease specialist, about COVID and the latest developments around the virus. And you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We've got a couple of questions about variants. This listener writes, when we hear of a new variant spreading fast somewhere in the world, we know we'll get here pretty soon. Have you heard of any variants of concern now? And then Catherine also writes, Eric Topol is one of the few talking about the possibility of a pan-vaccine that is agnostic to variants. Is that in development or is that just a pipe dream? So any new variants? Could a pan-vaccine get to it?
So great questions. I love them. So
the new variants are awesome.
The game of the world is really dominated by Omicron right now, and Omicron's party of five that I call them. So BA1, which has kind of gone off now, BA2 and its sibling BA2.12.1, which is mainly a US and UK thing. And then the new kids on the block, BA4 and BA5, started off in South Africa, moved to Europe, particularly Portugal, where it kind of exploded. And then it's coming to the US, Canada, and other parts of the world right now. It's going to be the latest threat. But nothing really else on the world scene so far, because these variants are so great at transmission that they're keeping everyone, all the other mutations that are occurring naturally every 2 weeks, we're getting a new mutation at bay. And we've seen that before in the days of Lambda and Mu, if you remember, people were worried about those. But during that time, we had Delta kind of keeping them at bay. It's the same thing that's happening now with these Omicron flavors. In terms of the other question, which is the future of vaccines, I think it's a medium-term goal. I wouldn't even say long-term, medium, hopefully, where we may get, what's called a universal COVID vaccine or coronavirus vaccine. And so far, we've been banking on the spike protein because the antibodies we make and the immune response we make towards it seems to really protect well. But as the spike protein changes with the new variants, it doesn't really protect well against just infection, although it protects against going to the hospital. So I think people are trying to work on using or incorporating into the vaccine parts of the virus that don't change, that are similar all the time. But those parts are hard to see. So that's why it's taking a longer time to develop a vaccine that's this pan-coronavirus vaccine. But if developed, would be amazing because it will help against just not just COVID, but other viruses that may cause colds, et cetera, and the other SARS-like viruses like the Middle Eastern camel disease, MERS, and the original SARS, and maybe future SARS as well.
Well, Cynthia writes, EverShield is one tool to prevent COVID among the immunocompromised. Could Dr. Chenong comment on whether that is still effective for the new variants?
That's a great question. So far, the data suggests that EverShield is still effective against BA4 and BA5. But the listener is right. We can't take it for granted that these monoclonal antibodies are going to be effective every time a new variant comes on board, because they are pre-made, and it's kind of like a lock and a key. If the key doesn't fit in the lock, which is the antibodies and the new variant, the spike protein, then it's not going to work because it's somebody else's, some antibodies made in a factory. But it turns out that EverShield still has activity against BA4 and BA5, luckily.
Well, it's been over a year since California basically reopened, right? I think it was June 15th. We are in a better place, right, Dr. Chenong, even with what feels like everybody around us getting COVID?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, if we were back in a year ago and we had this amount of virus in the community, we would be swarming in the hospitals. We wouldn't be able to take care of anybody else. There'll be mobile hospitals in Golden Gate Park. I think we're in such in a different place now because of the power of vaccines and boosting. The Bay Area has the highest uptake of vaccines across all age groups in the country. If you think of kids 5 to 11, for example, national statistics, 30%, Bay Area over 60%. If you looked at adolescents, we're more than 90%. So again, it really is protecting our hospital, keeping people from getting very ill. But that's not to talk about some of the other things that we are seeing with the disruptions. And I think the lingering, ache of this thing still being with us after all this time.
Well, Dr. Chenong, so appreciate again you coming on to answer our listeners' questions and to share your experiences and insights.
My pleasure, Mina. Thanks so much for having me on.
Dr. Peter Chin-Hong, infectious disease specialist of UCSF Medical Center. My thanks to Caroline Smith for producing today's segments, and my thanks, as always, to our listeners for their great, great questions and sharing their experiences. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.